From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what does Governor Rick Snyder have to say about the hundreds of same-sex couples who got married last weekend?
Although the marriages were legal, what the state does is reinstate Michigan law. And under Michigan law, it says the state of Michigan will not recognize the fact that they're married.
Plus, an oil spill into Lake Michigan from a BP refinery in Indiana.
And somehow a slug of oil got into the cooling system and was pumped right out into the lake.
And the story of a man who built some of the most recognizable structures in Michigan after a youth fighting the Nazis and the communists.
You know, he says in the book, he said, I think Americans have a little bit different outlook on freedom than I do. And he says, you know, I'd like them to stop and think about it.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. The number of adults who smoke cigarettes is the lowest it's been in decades, 19% in 2010 compared to more than double that in 1965. But now there are e-cigarettes, and it seems the use of these battery-powered nicotine inhalers is growing faster than science can figure out its possible effects. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we explore the health risks of so-called vaping and what the state's doing to keep e-cigs out of the hands of minors. But first, from elation to a state of limbo. That's the status of same-sex couples in Michigan who had hoped to marry following last Friday's ruling from federal Judge Bernard Friedman, a ruling that struck down Michigan's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. More than 300 couples rushed to speak their vows Saturday before the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay of Judge Friedman's ruling until all appeals proceedings conclude. And now we have heard from Governor Rick Snyder about those couples. Joining us now is MLive's Capitol correspondent, Jonathan Osting. So what has Governor Snyder decided to say in terms of granting legal recognition to couples who married last weekend?
The governor said today he believes that the marriages were, in fact, performed legally. But that's since the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals stayed Friedman's Friday ruling. Michigan law is back in place. And Michigan law doesn't just prohibit same-sex marriages from happening, it prohibits the state from recognizing them, whether they're performed in Michigan or another state that does allow them. So the governor essentially says his hands are tied here and the state won't be recognizing those marriages even though they were legally performed.
So if I'm one of these couples, I'm saying to myself, so legal on Saturday, but today...
Yeah, exactly. The governor said that he wanted to provide some clarity. I'm not sure he actually did that. I mean, essentially, he's saying the situation remains the same. State recognizes they were legally performed, but won't recognize them for any other purpose moving forward. So the state of legal limbo definitely still in play for those couples that were married this weekend.
So benefits to a spouse or adoptions by those couples or the joint filing of state income tax forms, all of that is off the table until this appeal process goes through.
All of the above, yeah. And the appeals process could be, months in the making. I mean, the court set a schedule for briefings, asking for documents to be turned in May and June. So it doesn't seem like we're going to have any resolution anytime soon.
Let's look at the appeals court ruling that stayed Judge Friedman's decision. It was 2-1. What did the majority opinion say? Why did they side with the state?
Well, they basically said that the Supreme Court issued a stay on a Utah case under similar circumstances. So they didn't really get into the nuts and bolts. They just said they wanted to remain consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court did in that Utah case.
And we know that federal appeals court judge Helene White did write a dissenting opinion. What did she say?
Yeah, I mean, basically, in most cases like this, the court takes sort of a four-pronged approach, and they look at a number of different issues, such as whether the benefits of staying the ruling will outweigh the harm that it will cause the plaintiffs who won the case at the lower level. And Judge White said the state did not, in fact, prove that, which is why she dissented.
Now, we know, as you say, it'll be several months before the appeals court issues its ruling, and then I'm sure this is on a fast track to the U.S. Supreme Court, isn't it?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, obviously, when more and more states are dealing with the same issue, that should provide an impetus to the Supreme Court to take it up. They, of course, had the opportunity to weigh in last summer, and they chose not to. They chose to just focus on the Defense of Marriage Act and leave this question open. So I assume they knew that this issue would come back before them at some point, but how soon it can is an open question. I mean, it might be 2015 or even later.
In the meantime, Governor Snyder attempting to clarify a position. It sounds as though things are left fairly muddied, and I know the LGBT community would like him to get off the fence one way or the other, but it seems like he's trying very hard to stay on that fence.
Exactly. He's walking the legal line. I mean, he's saying, I'm going to do whatever the courts do. I've reviewed this with my attorneys, and here's what we believe is the correct way to implement the ruling and the stay. Of course, people do want to know the governor's personal opinion as well. In 2010, he did give a brief statement that said marriage is between one man and one woman, but suggested that couples should be allowed to enter into legal contracts together. Of course, 4 years later, a lot of personal opinions have changed in this state, and people do want to know where the governor stands, but he's not willing to share that right now.
MLive Capitol correspondent Jonathan Osting. Jonathan, thanks for talking with us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
An oil spill from a BP refinery in Whiting, Indiana this week is raising new worries about the stepped-up processing of Canadian tar sands oil and threats to Lake Michigan. BP confirms the oil leak happened Monday. We're joined now by Michael Hawthorne, a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Very good to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Well, considering 7 million people in Chicagoland depend on Lake Michigan for drinking water, even a little tiny spill must be cause for concern.
It is, I think. Anytime you hear about pollution in Lake Michigan, people's ears perk up. And there have been problems and concerns about this particular refinery for a number of years, going back to when they wanted a new permit to increase the amount of pollution they could potentially release into Lake Michigan. It is one of the biggest polluters, industrial polluters, at least on Lake Michigan. So anytime there's something involving BP, people pay attention.
So tell us about this Whiting refinery, because wasn't it recently upgraded so they could process more tar sands oil from Alberta?
It was. It goes back. It's one of the oldest refineries in the country. Actually, it goes back to John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. But more recently, it's been substantially upgraded. About $4 billion BP spent on that refinery to process more of the Canadian tar sands oil coming from a region of Alberta. And there's a lot of issues that come along with that. That type of oil is very heavy. It's dirtier. It takes more energy to process. And so at various points in time, BP has sought permission to at least have the authority to release more pollution into the lake. And there's been an ongoing dispute with BP, along with federal environmental regulators and environmental groups, essentially trying to hold them accountable and make sure that what they're doing doesn't violate any environmental laws.
And we know BP's on extremely thin ice, isn't it, with the U.S. government after that 2010 well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico? Because if you're the company behind the worst offshore oil spill in American history, this latest spill is not going to improve your image.
I think that they're very concerned about that. The good news, it looks like, if it's good news, let's put it, I guess, into context. Mm-hmm. With something like, 4.9 billion gallons or something like that from the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. We don't know yet just how much oil was released from the refinery into Lake Michigan a couple of days ago. Some people, at least off the record from the company, were suggesting it was about 10 barrels, 12 barrels. Not a lot in relative terms. And given the amount of pollution that's already going into the lake from that part of northwest Indiana, how much effect it had on the lake is at least in the eyes of environmental regulators, fairly minimal.
Michael, what does BP say happened at the refinery that led to the spill?
Well, that's what's so confusing. They just spent all this money upgrading the refinery, and one of the centerpieces, or the actual centerpiece of that project, was something called a crude distillation unit. It's one of the first steps in the processing of crude oil into gasoline and other fuels. This particular unit came online just in July of 2013, and already something's happened. So at least from what BP and what federal officials told me in the last 24 hours, what's happened is there's like a cooling system, almost like a car radiator that's kind of going throughout the refinery.
Mm-hmm.
It's sealed. It's taking water from the lake, circulating it through the refinery to keep the equipment from overheating and then discharging back out into the lake. Oil is never supposed to come in direct contact with that cooling water. But for some reason, there was a malfunction at this crude distillation unit, not even in production for a year now. And somehow a slug of oil got into the cooling system and was pumped right out into the lake.
Wow. Now, do we have a sense how far it spread out into the lake and whether it had environmental impact?
The area where the refinery is in kind of like a makeshift cove where, in the bend in the south western shore of the lake, and it looks like, at least from when the EPA and the Coast Guard flew over the scene yesterday, and from what they were able to determine in terms of seeing an oil sheen on the water, that it looks like strong winds pushed most of that oil into this sandy cove between the refinery and a steel mill that's nearby at the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal. The weather was really cold. Some of the oil hardened into these little balls of almost waxy consistency, and there were crews out on this sandy beach that's on BP's property yesterday, literally picking up these tiny pieces of waxy oil by hand.
Lovely. When we think about possible environmental impact with wildlife or human health, does the EPA have any sense that that has happened?
At this point, at least yesterday, and I don't think anything's changed since then, they see no impact on wildlife or human health.
And I've got to imagine for environmental groups who are already unhappy with the plant and they were opposed to that upgrade and the larger processing, that they've got to be very concerned since Monday's spill.
Well, I think what they've seen over time, and if you look at the record of this, is in many cases Indiana regulators and BP have kind of worked in lockstep on these issues, and the federal government officials from Michigan and Illinois and environmental groups have had to go in there, kind of look at the fine print of the permits that are granted by the state of Indiana, and make sure that the proper monitoring is going on and that the limits on pollution are set at a point that it's not going to be detrimental to the lake or people who get their drinking water from Lake Michigan.
So the cleanup effort continues, but even more importantly is figuring out how that slug of oil got into that cooling system.
I'd like to know myself.
Michael Hawthorne, reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside, Michael.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The next time you're in downtown Detroit and you note Cobo Center or the People Mover, or you're in Ypsilanti and you see Washtenaw Community College or Providence Hospital in Southfield or the Pontiac Silverdome, stop for a moment and remember this name, Charles Novacek. He was born in what was then Czechoslovakia and grew up through his country's occupation by the Nazis and then the Communists. He began training as a resistance fighter at the age of 11 and continued the fight as he grew up. He endured prison and torture under the Communists before ultimately escaping to a new life in Michigan. Charles Novacek became a noted engineer in Michigan, working on many projects that still stand today, including the ones I mentioned. And before he died in 2007, he wrote a memoir entitled Border Crossings, Coming of Age in the Czech Resistance. The book has now been published by Charles Novacek's wife, Sandra, and it's a pleasure to welcome Sandra Novacek to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
There really are two very remarkable stories here. First, your late husband's life as a resistance fighter against the Nazis and then the communist regime in his homeland. But there's also the stories of how you pushed through and came to publish his memoir to ensure that his story will live on. And I want to start there. You two met in the mid-90s.
We did. We met in 1996.
And this was long after his harrowing life in what was then Czechoslovakia, and his wife Valentina had died 2 years earlier?
Correct. Yes.
So you met, and when did you become aware that he had had such an incredible youth?
Well, I heard a little bit about it when a matchmaker was sent to me. I was the director of a small library in Heartland, Michigan. And one of my library patrons ended up being Charles' art teacher. And a friend of hers was also a Heartland art teacher. And they had talked to Charles 2 years after his wife had died and, you know, he said he really wanted to, you know, start a new relationship. And so the Heartland High School art teacher came over to my building and she said, Sandy, I want to introduce you to this wonderful man. And she started telling me a little bit about his life, that he was involved in the resistance during World War II. And, you know, he was he escaped and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. She didn't tell me too much, but that's when I first heard about it.
So, you clicked. And as he writes about meeting you, it really was a wonderful new chapter in his life. Where you know, he wasn't lonely, and it was really a great, not quite a, well, about a little about a, over a decade that you had together.
Mm-hmm. That's right, almost 11 years.
And and what about the book? How had he written it? Was he writing it? Did you help him write it?
Well, you know, I think in the back of his mind, he always knew that he was going to be writing this book. That's one of the reasons that when he retired, he decided to go back to school, because then he did go to the University of Michigan Dearborn. He got 2 degrees there, and he always took writing classes because he wanted to perfect his writing. And so he kept working at it. And oftentimes when he would have a class assignment, he would write about a little segment or a little vignette about a segment of his life. And, you know, oftentimes it was the experiences he had in the Czech resistance. And so by the time I met him, he had, you know, he had a few chapters put together. But he didn't officially start working on the book until the year 2000. And I helped him, but, you know, he was pretty independent. And I always read things and I'd comment on them. But I think he usually won out.
You were his sounding board, if it will.
Yeah.
And Charles started as such a youngster when he entered the resistance. Why did he start training at such an early age with the Czech resistance?
You know, he actually started early in his life. His father was in World War I. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a Czech legionnaire. And, of course, his father said, you read that in the book, you know, that was the last war, as many other people said, you know, the war to end all wars.
That's right.
And but, you know, I think in the back of his mind, his dad didn't really believe that. And so Charles had an older sister, and the parents both taught their children survival skills early on, taught them how to forage for food. And they were doing all that, you know, at 3, 5, 6, 7 years old. But Charles' uncle, Joseph Robotka, was a very high-level military figure in the country. And he had a lot of, insight into the activities that were going on, and he knew what was happening with the Nazis and so on.
He could see the storm clouds
getting
darker and darker.
Exactly. And, of course, he was very close to Charles' father. And when, you know, word got out when the Nazis actually occupied the country, of course, Charles' uncle and Charles' father were not going to put up with that, because they had enjoyed the wonderful democracy that had actually formed in their country in 1918. And they were so happy about that. And there was no way that they were going to stand for the Nazis coming into the country. So Uncle Joseph, with all of his connections and his power, got Charles' father into it. And Charles' father just decided that his whole family had to become involved.
So when Charles was how old? How old was he? Was he really actually began
He was actually 11. The country, the Munich Agreement was actually in 1938. And that's when the first things really started to look bad. And it's kind of like what you've heard, on the news recently, where even, Hillary Clinton was comparing what's going on in Ukraine to the occupation of Czechoslovakia in 1938, because it was really pretty scary.
And I think for a lot of the readers, people will be familiar with stories of life under Nazi occupation. Mm-hmm. We've seen movies.
Yeah.
We have read books. And he was right in the middle of it, right to the very end. And, of course, their prayer was, the end of the war, we'll get the Germans out. And then literally from the frying pan into the fire, in came the Soviets and the communist regime.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you, if you could read an excerpt for us, because here he did. He began as a resistance fighter against the communists, and the Germans didn't snatch him up, but the communists got him in Prague. Ironically, he was just strolling around the city center at lunchtime. So if you'd read us an excerpt from the book after the communist regime grabbed him.
Okay, the heading above it says mid-July 1948, prison somewhere in Bohemia. The stench of excrement and condensation dripping from rocky walls made the small cubicle feel like a medieval dungeon. I was not a heretic, yet they tortured and beat me every day. Their shouts echoed, ringing in my 20-year-old ears. Who are you working for? When they were through with me, I couldn't walk, so they dragged me by my feet from the first floor interrogation room down the stone stairs. My head bounced hard on each step, making it ache with numb, buzzing pain. Then they dumped me onto a cold floor in a tiny cell. I felt the reverberation as they slammed the rusty steel door. I began to lose track of time, but I didn't lose the hope of wearing out the nameless bastards. It occurred to me that they may have been remnants of the Gestapo or the Schutzstaffel, SS. These men, new Czech communist recruits, passionately executed the orders of their chiefs and seemingly enjoyed every minute of it.
That's Sandra Novacek reading from her husband Charles Novacek's memoir, which is called Border Crossings, Coming of Age in the Czech Resistance. And he does escape. He was truly, I'm sure, at the brink of being eliminated by the communists, and he was able to escape, went on to escape to South America, and then eventually made his way to Michigan, where he had a more than three-decade career as an engineer. What brought him to Michigan?
Well, actually, what brought him here was Valentina, his wife. She was also a refugee, mm-hmm. actually, from Latvia. And she had stayed back in Europe to finish her medical degree. She actually was a dentist. But her family, her mother and her father and her brother, had come to Michigan, and they were mm-hmm. in Detroit. And so that was their, you know, their goal, to get with Charles' family, or with Valentina's
yes.
family.
So they came to Southeast Michigan. And how did he come to feel about this new corner of the world that he called home, Southeast Michigan?
Well, I think he was really excited. And I, you know, kind of go back to the whole his childhood, when his father would tell him stories about how their country of Czechoslovakia was formed. And, you know, of course, he heard cowboy stories, too. And but he, you know, the whole idea of the democracy and the freedom and, you know, the immigrating to the place where he could realize the American dream. I mean, that was exciting to him. However, he was very scared because he didn't know a word of English. And so here he was, like so many immigrants. He's very, very intelligent, very well, you know, educated. And yet, you know, he seems like a dummy.
Yes, because he had no English.
You know, yeah, no one understood him. So it was really difficult at first.
So he learned his English. Yeah. He became a professional engineer. And he even recounts in Border Crossings watching his father, when Charles was a little boy, watching his father rebuild a bridge
yeah.
that had washed out, and that he was so fascinated with that. And he remembered that as he, many, many years later, built the People Mover. He was the supervisor of the People Mover.
The quality assurance manager, yep.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you. So did the older man that you met in 1996, did you see that kind? Was he the kind of man who was so tough beyond description during that torture and being so wily and you know, not just one siege of resistance under the Nazis, but then another under the communists? Was that guy still in there, or had he morphed and changed by the time you met him?
He was very tough. Mm-hmm. He also was mellowing in his older age. I'm sure that his children would probably say that. But he was very, very tough. And I'll just tell you one thing. When I met him, he was 69 years old, and he was 19 years older than me. And I can remember he had gotten a little tiny retirement home in Venezuela because he still had friends there. And, of course, he'd lived there for, you know, many years.
Because that's where he went first when he escaped from Czechoslovakia. Yeah.
And so here's this roof, and we get to this house, and he says, oh, my gosh, the roof is bad, and the place needs to get painted, and, oh, there's just so much. All of a sudden, the next thing I know, he's up on the roof, and he's running around, and he's a civil engineer, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's jumping up and down. He's doing all this, and, I mean, and I'm, you know, 19 years younger, and I'm exhausted, you know, just watching him. But he was determined. His body, you know, had really suffered a lot from the the trials and tribulations that he had gone through.
Yes.
And I think, you know, he had just held so much inside of him for all of his years of work that by the time he retired, he, you know, his body just started to go. But he had two knees that needed to be replaced and a pretty bad hip. And you'd never know it because he kept pushing forward. He had this great drive to be productive and to accomplish.
No,
and he was an inspiration.
Much the same way we see the way he hung on during literally who knows how much time that he was being tortured by the communists. What do you hope people will understand about Charles Novacek?
Well, Charles had some definite reasons for wanting to publish the book. He wanted people to know about the country of Czechoslovakia because that's not who you usually hear about when you hear about World War II. He wanted people to know there was a Czech resistance and that the Czech resistance actually, though they weren't as successful as the French or, you know, other resistance groups, the Polish, they did do some very wonderful things. One of them, which was quite controversial but still very, very brave, was the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, who was a very, very high-level Nazi.
He was very much part of engineering the Final Solution.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. So that was, you know, that was the Czech resistance and, of course, their government in exile that were involved in that. So he wanted people to know that. But he also, it's almost like a cautionary tale. He's just trying to let people know that freedom, you know, freedom is something that unfortunately many of us take for granted and that he found in during his lifetime that you can be free and all of a sudden the next day without really, you know, too much notice, it's your freedom is taken away. And, you know, a country has occupied your own land. And, you know, he loved America. He lived in this country longer than he ever lived in Czechoslovakia, his homeland. But, you know, he says in the book, he said, I think Americans have a little bit different outlook on freedom than I do. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, I'd like them to stop and think about it, you know. And so I think that's important, you know. And then, of course, the whole thing of when World War II ended, the communists came into the country.
That is going to open a lot of eyes here in America. I mean, not that those of us who grew up through the Cold War had that idea that, you know, things were bad behind what we call the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
But to really see it through the eyes of someone who was caught up in that it's a remarkable story. Border Crossings, Coming of Age in the Czech Resistance. It's won many book awards, including the Midwest Book Awards Gold Medal for Autobiography and Memoir. And you can learn more by going to charlesnovacekbooks.com. That's charlesnovacekbooks.com. And we put a link on our website at michiganradio.org. Sandra Novacek, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your husband's remarkable story with us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The office would not be what it is today without the cubicle, another Michigan-made invention.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
The American office used to be rows of desks in a huge room with zero privacy. All of that changed when the Michigan-based company Herman Miller unintentionally introduced the cubicle. Mark Sherman of Herman Miller explains the technology's history, which began when the company's founder met inventor Robert Probst.
He had an unexpected conversation with Probst that turned into a long conversation, and he was really intrigued by this guy's brilliant sort of inventive mind. So ultimately, we set him up as the hired consultant to lead a new research and development program within Herman Miller. Out of that, one of the first challenges that he began to look at was designing his own office. He began to envision an ideal sort of knowledge-driven workplace that would provide and encourage communication and collaboration. Then in 68, we introduced Action Office 2, as it was dubbed at the time, and that is what many people think of today as the cube. But here's the key point. Probst never intended for it to be applied as a cube.
He didn't. Well, then exactly what was the technology of the Action Office?
Sure. So it was a set of components, a monolithic panel, meaning that sort of standing panel that we're all familiar with, with the associated hardware that will allow you to connect those panels to create what he envisioned and what was the original intent is very organic shapes. Think more like half honeycombs or even two-sided workstations that gave some sense of definition for the individual but did not wall you off. And in fact, I had occasion to talk to Probst a number of times before his passing. One of the things that he really would bristle at was being called the father of the cubicle because, as I said, that was never his intent.
Interesting. But the technology, the ideas, and the reinventing the American office from that bullpen began with Herman Miller Designers.
Very true.
Thank you so much, Mark Sherman of Herman Miller. It was great talking with you and getting a really interesting history lesson.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
You may have seen someone firing one up in a restaurant where you thought smoking was banned. Or maybe you tried to kick a cigarette habit by using one, an electronic cigarette. These are the battery-powered inhalers that are loaded with a replaceable or refillable cartridge of liquid juice that contains nicotine, solvents, and flavors. Puffing on an e-cig is called vaping, and there is little doubt vaping is here to stay. E-cig sales are still a fraction of the tobacco cigarette market, but e-cig sales are booming as tobacco cigarette sales continue to decline. Right now, there's no regulation on e-cigs, and in Michigan, there's nothing to keep them from being sold to minors. And that has ignited debate in Lansing. Associated Press reporter Emma Fidel has been looking into Michigan's efforts to keep those e-cigs out of the hands of kids under age 18. Welcome to the program, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
So what do we know so far, if anything, about the health risks of vaping?
Well, we're still only a few years into the popularity of vaping. So there have been multiple studies done, but there isn't really a consensus yet about what the effects are in the short term and especially in the long term. It's kind of, you know, early enough in the e-cigarette game that the scientific community hasn't decided yet how bad these can be for you.
And early enough in the vaping game that we don't have any regulations from the Food and Drug Administration.
Right. So one of the big debates going on is how these should be regulated and who should regulate them. Because there's no regulation, it's hard to know exactly what's in them. You know, there are hundreds of different types of e-cigarettes out there, and while most of them contain some similar chemicals, it's hard to know exactly what's in each one.
And we know that 27 states have banned the sale of e-cigs to minors because we're certainly seeing middle and high school students' use of e-cigs. We saw more than doubled from 2011 to 2012. So the kids are on to it. But so what's happening in Lansing to regulate the sale?
Well, right now there's some disagreement in Lansing over how to regulate them. Everybody pretty much is on the same page about wanting to keep them out of the hands of kids. That's a priority.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a question of how to characterize e-cigarettes in the process of doing that. So there are a few bills that have passed the Senate so far in Lansing that would make it illegal to sell e-cigarettes to kids and would also make it illegal for kids to possess e-cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Now, those are supported by the tobacco industry and opposed by Governor Snyder's administration and some of the health groups that say the problem with that legislation, while the intention might be good, they argue that the legislation sets e-cigarettes apart from regular tobacco, essentially giving it a special status. So their concern is that down the line, e-cigarette manufacturers could, you know, avoid future regulation because they've been put into a separate category.
And your story for the Associated Press notes that e-cigarettes are often produced by the very same parent companies as traditional tobacco cigarettes.
That's right. In the past couple of years, the parent companies of, say, Philip Morris, Lorillard, they're producing e-cigarettes too. So the opponents of e-cigarettes, or I should say the health groups, they definitely bring that up often, is that there's kind of this conflict of interest involved.
And knowing that they're selling flavors like, oh, I don't know, Pina Colada, Cherry Crush, Bubblegum, Vivid Vanilla, who are these really being marketed to?
Yeah, and that's something that the health groups bring up a lot as well. You know, you're starting to see advertisements for e-cigarettes more and more frequently. They're coming into pop culture as kind of a cool new thing. Just this season on House of Cards, there was an e-cigarette prominently featured. It's the question that health groups are asking is whether tobacco companies are being, you know, are following regulations that exist for regular cigarettes about marketing and selling to minors. And the health groups say that they are not doing that currently, and they're trying to avoid that.
And the health groups are worried that the e-cigs are really more of a gateway to nicotine use than a safer way for smokers to get their fix.
Right. That's one argument, too. It hasn't really been proven yet whether or not these can actually help people quit. Health groups say that, you know, why would you promote an unknown when you know that nicotine patches, for example, you know the success rate of those, you know, the side effect or whatever else. But the question about whether or not these could appeal to non-smokers because they are safer, you know, that's another question they raise, is people believe e-cigarettes to be safer. And let's face it, there are fewer chemicals and then there's no tar. But it's a question of, could this, you know, hook people on nicotine who otherwise wouldn't be hooked?
I'm talking to Associated Press reporter Emma Fidel, who's been looking into Michigan's efforts to keep e-cigs out of the hands of minors, so for kids under age 18. And Senate Bill 667 and 668 would do that. They would regulate the sale of e-cigs, ban the sale of e-cigs to minors. Yet Governor Snyder and several big health groups oppose these bills. And then from the House, we have House Bill 5393, which does have the support of groups like the American Cancer Society and the American Lung Association. How does it differ, Emma, from the two Senate bills?
So the House bill would define e-cigarettes as a tobacco product. They right now in the Senate bills would not be defined that way. It would refer to them as a separate entity, whereas in the House bill, e-cigarettes would fall under the same umbrella as traditional cigarettes, so that down the line, they could be taxed and regulated in a similar way as well.
So what should we watch for?
Well, both sets of legislation are in the House committee right now, and we're looking to see what the committee will do with them and whether or not Representative Haynes and the administration can kind of gin up support for their alternative to the very popular Senate bills.
Associated Press reporter Emma Fidel filling us in on what's happening in Lansing to keep e-cigarettes out of the hands of minors. Emma, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How do you guide your city or town into the future without losing those elements from the past that made it special, livable, with a true sense of place? Well, that's a challenge that many towns in Michigan face. A lot of small towns have lost their unique look. They're buried by a profusion of generic shopping strips, a lot of gas stations, drugstores, and fast food restaurants. And then there are the wide freeways and highways that can really carve a city up. Well, the city of Marquette is an example of a city that is redefining itself, yet making itself something more special, more livable, and walkable. And what they're doing in Marquette can be a model for towns and cities all over Michigan. We're joined now by Dennis Stakowitz. He's Director of Planning and Community Development for Marquette.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be participating today.
Dennis, take us back about 10 years ago. What happened in 2004 that set you on the path to the city that you have today?
Well, back in 2004, we were kind of considered to be a city that was, you know, for lack of a better term, a city at a crossroads. We had experienced a lengthened shift in the local economy. Up to that point, we had been one primarily of industry. We were a port city on Lake Superior, tied to the iron industry, and we really saw a shift in that from that type of industry really to services such as healthcare and education. And when we were experiencing that shift, we started out with a comprehensive rewrite of the community master plan, and that took place in about 2004, and after working with the community, we came out of that with a vision, and we had a statement that we wanted to become the premier livable, walkable winter city in North America, which was kind of a paradigm shift from what was pretty much up to that point in time an industry town.
So can you give us an idea, Dennis, of what got tossed or what got kept and what was new in the community master plan?
Well, one of the things that you look at when you go through a planning exercise is you really look at your assets that you have and what you'd like to maintain, and then you build a community consensus around those assets and how you can use those on where you want to go. And some of the goals that were brought forward in that process included creating or preserving, in some cases, viable and livable neighborhoods, maintaining our historic and diverse downtown, creating an efficient, functional, and connected transportation system. And that, what was unique about it at that time was that also included being a walkable community, looking at multimodal forms of transportation, looking at ways to foster economic diversity, and really find a way to promote Marquette's, you know, different seasons and natural resources and really the great cultural diversity that we have here in our town. And I really like to go back to the transportation model, because one early example that we had was a development of a linear parkway, and it was along an abandoned railroad line that bisects the city. And as simple as it may sound, we drafted a plan for a linear park where we put a bike path on top of that, but that really became the spine and the impetus for a walkable community movement of sorts.
So something that was a detriment, was just this thing sitting there, became really a catalyst.
It became a catalyst for not only the walkable communities movement, multimodal forms of transportation, but it also just became a tangible example of what you can do without spending a lot of money and create a community asset that links things together. It really was kind of what I consider the tipping point in terms of something tangible that we could provide to the community to help them understand what we were promoting in planning documents.
And another thing that you've done is essentially changed the city's relationship with the waterfront.
We have. Because we were an industrial city at one point in time, we had our Lower Harbor Park at one point in time, they were coal yards.
Huh.
And it looked at some point, when you look at it from a land use planning perspective, it historically looked like the city turned its back to the waterfront. We had a lot of industrial activity along the waterfront, and backs of the buildings were facing the waterfront because people don't embrace looking at coal piles. Well, as that industry left Marquette, the community turned its focus back to the water. We had, in the late 90s, early 2000, we had a lakeshore task force, and it was a number of community-engaged citizens that got together and talked about strategic planning for the waterfront. We started embracing land use policies that would reclaim our waterfront and started, you know, putting that focused effort back to putting that in the hands of the community.
Kind of what we're hearing in the city of Detroit, and something that makes downtown Chicago so vibrant when you know that you're really embracing that lakeshore.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I think some people can relate to it, and specifically in your area, I'm sure there's people that have probably taken more trips to Chicago than Marquette. However, what one way to really describe what we've done is, as you go down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago and you have a physical, so that road becomes the physical separation between the public waterfront and then the commercial and private activity to the west of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what we've created in Marquette, just to a much, much smaller scale.
And it does work. I'm speaking with Dennis Stakowitz. Dennis is the Director of Planning and Community Development for Marquette. As we explore the way that this city made itself the premier livable, walkable winter city in North America, is all of this is happening through these 10 years since you rewrote the community master plan, Dennis, what do you think all of this has meant to the spirit of the people who live and work in Marquette?
Well, the spirit of the people who live in Marquette are what make Marquette what it is. And, you know, you can't twist that around. You can sound like you're kind of patting the community on the back, but I think you need to, because Marquette's vision always was and always will be based upon input from its very engaged citizens. I mean, this community understands where it wants to go, and they participate in the activity. It's really, you know, we as stewards or administrative folks that work with the planning process, we try to provide a transparent, fair process that would give everybody equal opportunity to participate. But it's really up to the citizens' community members to get involved, roll up their sleeves, and pay attention and participate and tell us how they want their community to look. And they've done that. We've had a number of planning efforts that were, although they were led by the planning department, we can't do it without the participation and ownership of the community. And they've been very, very open to some really progressive type of land use codes and different planning efforts that we've done.
So this community buy-in is really, really key.
It's extremely, extremely important. Educate the community to what assets it has, and then start building consensus around those assets and how you can move forward and do that. You know, there's lots of talk in the state nowadays about placemaking.
Yes.
That's great. I'm glad that it's finally being discussed. I like to say that placemaking is nothing more than good urban planning, and I like to think we've been doing it before it was called placemaking. But I am glad that it's being touted and created in more of a marketing campaign, because it really promotes good planning.
And can the kinds of things you've done be repeated around Michigan? And I'm thinking of cities, let's just say Flint, for instance, that also have seen what they relied on for generations erode away. So there you are left with now what? And money is scarce and people get kind of defeated. So does it take spirit, creativity, big dollars? What makes the biggest difference?
Well, you know, I think any outside cities that look for Marquette on a model of how to achieve success, I really think it comes back to community planning. I mean, you embrace community engagement and collaboration, and I can't beat on this enough. It all starts with a discussion. You have to identify yourself and your strengths. Hmm. What is your community? How can you leverage your existing assets? Identify some goals and recognize that your small goals are achievable. Whether it's, you know, revamping your small downtown district and approaching it from a tourism perspective by putting in some benches and lighting and some of those things along pathways, all of that stuff is important in terms of building momentum. Okay, you it's kind of like the low-hanging fruit theory. You identify what your assets are. And even though you have big goals, along the way there are some things that are going to require less effort, but in turn it's going to be something that the public can see and they're going to feel proud, and you can build off of that momentum. But it really comes back down to, for instance, a place like Flint, you have to sit down and start the discussion, and it has to be an honest discussion. If you're sitting down at the table and you're saying, okay, we've lost industry, how do we recapture industry? And that's not going to happen anyhow, then you're defeating the purpose of the exercise. It needs to be a very honest discussion.
So it's a chance to basically take the old Etch-a-Sketch and shake it, clear the old drawing, and start anew.
Absolutely.
Dennis Stakowitz, the Director of Planning and Community Development for Marquette. Been a pleasure to talk to you, Dennis. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about all the good things that Marquette is doing, and hope the rest of the state can engage placemaking and move forward in a positive manner. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisgetter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.